Okay, well, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Solaire Report a guest who truly needs no introduction. Franklin Sanders is with us today, and we're going to talk about his new trilogy on his move to a place called Dogwood Mudhole. And if he has time, we're also going to touch base with him on the precious metals market. He's up in Pennsylvania on business for his church, which he in his busy schedule also does. So, Franklin, thank you for taking the time to join us on the Solaire Report.
Oh, I'm glad to do it.
Okay, so tell us how you and Susan, your amazing wife, who I just have to point out is maybe the hero this week on the Solaire Report, how you came to move from Memphis to Middle Tennessee to a place called Dogwood Mudhole.
Well, I don't have any better excuse than just to say that that's what we always wanted to do. And, you know, Y2K came along, and that was sort of a catalyst for us to get off the spot and do something. And we looked for about a year and a half for a farm, and then we moved out there. And pretty much not knowing anything about what we were going to get into, because neither one of us had grown up on a farm. But we wanted a family enterprise. And, so at that time, three of my children were married. Two of my children were married and already, had children of their own. And so they moved out there, and we still had three at home, which were nearly grown. And, so now out of seven children, there are five that still live and work around us. And some of those work in the, you know, in our enterprises with us, but primarily in the farm. And we just wanted to live a different way. We wanted a different thing out of life, than we had in an urban setting. And so we moved out. It's sort of like learning how to swim by jumping off the back of an aircraft carrier. It's a lot.
I'll never forget one of the funniest moments on the Solaire Report was years ago. I said to you, how did you and Susan learn how to farm? And you said, we killed a lot of animals. And I thought I could just hear some of the subscribers swoon. Oh, you know, because if you live in the city, you're so completely separated from the, you know, the reality of what life on the farm is like. So when you came out, let me just help everybody understand the context. You had a precious metals dealership and a newsletter and were also writing books, but then you added a farm, which is essentially livestock. So you're raising cattle and sheep and pigs. And then you built a church, and all the while you're also building houses and various different facilities for the various homes. So you're also, you know, you also kind of got into the home building business in addition. So you're talking about learning and building an enormous number of complex businesses and things. So it's fair to say it's a lot to learn. And it's been amazing to kind of watch you do it. So bring us up and tell us about the books and tell us what the books describe. You've written, this is a trilogy, you've written two. So start us off with the first two.
Well, in the first two, the first one starts right before we leave. But one thing I want to make clear is that we wanted a close-knit community, not just people in our family, but we wanted to build a close-knit community. And so that was one of the goals that we had. And we looked for a year and a half before we could find land that would be suitable for us, you know, suitable for our pocketbook and that would work for us. And then we moved everybody over in July of 99. And we put poor Justin and Ellen, we had a little 1,200 square foot farmhouse, and poor Justin and Ellen had all their stuff in this big back room and a baby. And then the rest of us were all stacked up sleeping wherever we could while we had bought a log house too. That's the shoe that, you know, well, we've done this program from the shoe numerous times.
Mm-hmm.
That had to be all refurbished and fixed up, and we roughly doubled the size of it. So when you start trying to build a community, you're going to invariably have to build the place for that community to inhabit, which is buildings and so forth. And you just learn and find out a lot of skills that you didn't know. One of the things that we did later, another family moved into our area and they wanted to build a house. And so that summer, this was probably in 2003 or four, that summer, we all sort of made a vow that we would help them every day get that house up. And so every day we'd work until 4 o'clock or 4:30. And of course you've got daylight in midsummer all the way to almost 9 o'clock. And we would all go over there. There was a fellow, James Bendowski, who was working with us, and then Justin and Wright, and I would all go over there and work with them. Well, they got that house up for less than $30 a square foot, and it's about a 2,000 square foot house. So you see what you add to somebody else's life. Of course, but when we got in the middle of that, I thought, this is crazy. I mean, we're going to kill ourselves trying to do this. But, you know, it's a monument to love. It's a monument to love for each other. And if communities would help, especially young couples starting out that way, so that they didn't have the burden of an enormous mortgage, imagine right. What difference. And this is not a shack that we built these folks, remember. I mean, of course, they were in charge of building it. We were just furnishing labor. But it's a big, nice place. And if we could do that for our children and our neighbors, just contribute part of that cost, just imagine they're not under that interest rate burden for 30 years.
Right. Now, when you say $30 a square foot, what do you think sort of the average home with a mortgage would have cost per square foot if a builder had done everything?
85, 90. Depends on where you are, you know. I mean, if you're in
right.
New York, 120. But at that
right.
time, in Memphis, it would have been about $75 or $85 a square foot.
Okay, so it made an enormous difference.
Oh, yeah. It's just.
Now, you told me that you had a group of other people who were planning on coming in Y2K, but they didn't last.
No, you know, as long as that pressure of the end of the world was on them, they were ready to adopt a different lifestyle. But when that passed away, you know, most of them scooted out and went back to the city. And I understand that, you know, I mean, rural life is not for everybody. Everybody doesn't want that kind of challenge, physical challenge, and that kind of responsibility, because it's a huge amount of responsibility. And I think, I mean, I'm not picking on anybody, but, and I'm not trying to build myself up, but I think, you know, avoiding responsibility is the national pastime in our, you know, in our present age. People don't, they just don't want to take responsibility for themselves. And it's a
right.
lot easier to sit back into this network of technology and say, well, I'm okay, I'm safe.
I can
handle this.
One of the things that I watched, because I came over and met you, I think, in 2004. You'd been out there 4 or 5 years, and so that was about 10 years ago. And one of the things I will say is that you and your family have one of the highest learning speeds of any group of people that I have ever met. You love to learn. You are always, morning, noon, and night, you're always sharing and talking and teaching each other. And it's just like a fantastic learning journey whenever you dip into the Sanders family, you know, doings. And that's part of what I think has made this so so successful, because it takes a lot of learning to, you know, farming is a very complex thing. A small farm is very, very complicated. It's a business, and you're talking about land and animals and, you know, taxes and regulation. It's a lot of stuff. And I think that's the challenge that a lot of people have in dealing with it, is trying to get a high enough learning speed.
Well, I don't think that's the main challenge, though. I think the main challenge, well, I'll say this, the main challenge for us was to learn to love each other. It's a horrible fact of human nature that we act the meanest toward the people we're supposed to love the most. And when you're working cheek by jowl with folks that you're kin to, you have a bad tendency to lose your temper and to say things you oughtn't say and get mad and so forth. And so I think what we really had to learn more than anything else was how to get along together and how to love each other. And that means how to forgive too. But any enterprise, any undertaking, and maybe people think it's mush-headed to call it love, but I'm talking about, you know, that hard, living crystalline thing called love that if you don't have, you can't live, or at least you can't live a happy and satisfied life. And any kind of enterprise, if the person who runs the enterprise doesn't have that kind of loving concern for the folks who are in the enterprise, it's not going to go anywhere. It's going to be a mess all the time. So that's the big lesson we had to learn. And then, of course, you know, there's a huge learning curve. You know, I'll give you an example. We got smacked with the learning curve just this year, this spring. Justin had been looking for a Jersey bull for several years out of a New Zealand bull called Landy. And the reason he was looking for him was because his genetics were such that animals out of him, cows out of him, did well on grass. They produced well on grass, and you didn't have to feed them any grain. And so we found this bull, and we bought him from a calf, and raised him up, had him out there in the field with the cows. And he had gotten up to be about 2.5 years old, and he was a handsome specimen. And during the winter, the boys were feeding alfalfa hay as a supplement to the cows, because they don't get much protein when they're just eating hay. So if you add in the alfalfa, they get more protein. And they'd take it out there, and there were 6 or 8 cows out there with the bull, and just drop it off for them. Well, about 11 o'clock, he was fine, and 1 o'clock, somebody drove by, and he was 4 hooves up in the field, dead.
Really?
Dead. And we couldn't figure out what had happened. Alfalfa is a legume, like clover, and legumes cause in cows, if they get too much of it, causes something called frothy bloat, and they literally just blow up and die, and within about an hour that happens. But we knew about that problem, but we just didn't think about it with alfalfa hay. And he just made a pig out of himself and ran the other cows off so he could eat all the alfalfa, and it killed him. And you know, sometimes the animal's in danger, sometimes you're in danger. Ignorance is no excuse when those things start happening.
Well, the title that we gave the Solaria Report today was Fructify. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I love about a market economy is if you're not being useful, you find out pretty quick, because you can't make it for less than it costs. You know, you can't sell it for more than it costs you to make it. And it is a ruthless discipline to constantly be focused on doing those things that add value and are of service to the people around you or the people you serve. You know, it can be a hard lesson, but it's an honest pathway. And what I've watched is what you and the Sanders clan have been doing is trying to do things that are economically sustainable. That is, you know, someone will pay you to do them, at least as much or more than it costs you to make them. And you've been working hard at that all your life, but certainly since you moved out to Dogwood Mudhole. And a lot of the 2 books that you've written so far really talk through the, you know, the trials and tribulations of trying to do that. And yet what you discovered was that wasn't true for many of your neighbors. So maybe if you could tell us about, you know, building one economy and discovering that the economy around you was something different.
Well, you know, if I look at not just my neighbors, but rural people around the United States, what's happened is that they have been they've been ruined by government, and maybe this is with the best intentions imaginable, but government back in the 1930s, the government, especially the federal government, got into the agriculture business, got into Boston agriculture and planning agriculture, and so one of the mantras that they began using after 1945 was get big or get out. And they convinced thousands and thousands of farmers, and then the debt dependence that the government encouraged then drove thousands and hundreds of thousands more out of business in the period from 1955 to 1970. And what happened was they listened to what the government said about producing, and they moved away from being polyculturalist to being monoculturalist. And what I mean by that is a polyculture farm is one where you've got several different species of animals. You're going to have, you know, cows, sheep, maybe goats, pigs, chickens. And then if you grow row crops, then you're going to rotate those crops, and you're going to grow several different things. You're not going to just grow corn in one year and soybean the next and call that a crop rotation, because it's not. But the government kept convincing these people they either had to get big or get out, and then they had to convince them. Then they convinced them that they had to have high cost inputs of debt, inputs of machinery, and so forth. And most of them just sold out little by little. They took jobs in town. The first generation worked in town and kept the farm, did all the same. They were used to working 12 hours, 18 hours a day anyway. It didn't make any difference to them. And then the next generation didn't want to work that hard, and so they just ran a few cows, and then they began selling off their farms. And so you've got a third generation that's completely dependent on a job in town, and their lifestyle has changed so that now instead of getting fresh whole food like whole milk and yard raised eggs and vegetables, everybody had a vegetable garden. Instead of that, they all have diabetes. They struggle with obesity. They have all of the civilized diseases, heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all of that stuff. So all of that's happened to these folks, and I think it happened because they didn't ask those questions you were talking about earlier. How can I best serve people and still make a living? I mean, one of the slaps in the face that we get all the time is, does this farm make money? Does it pay for itself? Because if it doesn't pay for itself, you can't keep doing it.
Right.
If you're not doing something that other people want, and you're not doing it at least as well and preferably better than other people, you can't keep doing it. The world, the cosmos, does not give you the right to run a bad restaurant or to be a bad accountant or any of those things. You have
one of the things that first shocked me when I started to, go on a journey of how we were going to really change things was to discover that there was a huge portion of the world that said that sustainability was a good thing, but they thought profitability was a bad thing. Couldn't figure out how that was going to work.
Well, I recently went to a holistic management conference, and holistic management was really, it's sort of an elaboration on the way people always managed before they had high cost inputs and chemicals to use. But a fellow named Alan Savory, who was a game warden in Rhodesia, started watching the way that animal herds, ruminant herds, worked, and he noticed that the grass, that they went in a big migration, and that the grass actually improved after they were there. And what most people think is overgrazing and means that the land needs rest, actually the land will do better if it is grazed, if it is worked. And so what you see is that the more intensively you work with nature, the better the product for everybody, the less environmental degradation there is. But it was interesting to me going to this holistic management class, and this was about grazing, a certain kind of grazing called mob grazing, where you put a lot of poundage on the ground for a short period of time. It was amazing to me that Ian, who was from South Africa, who was teaching the class, said that over and over and over. You've got to make a profit. You've got to make a profit. And if somebody said, well, what about doing this treatment or that treatment to my grass? He'd say, well, you can do that if you want to, but why are you going to spend that money?
And, right.
You know, the more you ask yourself that question, the more efficient you become. But even though this is the most environmentally friendly way that you could possibly manage animals and manage a farm, it also strongly emphasizes profitability. You just can't keep doing it if you don't have the money.
Right. Well, of course, though, we have so much more of the economy which has grown dependent on government or not-for-profit funding, which has been designed to, in fact, create dependency and create, you know, if I'm economic, I can gather power. If I'm not economic, then I'm dependent on these other sources that keep me dependent and have me learning in a way that you know, takes me away from learning that which can make me independent.
Yeah, I say to people over and over, all government money comes with a sock in the jaw.
Right.
All government money comes with a sock in the jaw. And one of the saddest examples of people who don't understand that is the environmental movement. They think that the best thing you can possibly do is to get all those animals off the ground. And they talk about what a problem cows are for the ozone, for the their CO2 production and things like that. And they don't understand that having animals actually improves the land. It provides low-cost protein, because we're talking about farms that don't feed corn. We're talking about using the grass that grows there naturally. It provides low-cost protein, and it protects the environment, and actually doesn't just protect the environment, but it improves the environment. Where we are, for instance, there's been a lot of clear-cutting and a lot of, you know, since the people moved off the land. Here's an example. When you change an environment, you don't know how all of those factors in the whole are working together. So you think, well, if we just get these people off the land, just get them off the land, let the trees grow back, everything will be okay. Well, guess what? You took the people off the land and you introduced the corporations who cut the timber off, and they weren't interested in stewarding that land and to make sure that land did not erode. They weren't planning on handing it over to their children in 50 years or their grandchildren in 100 years. So they didn't care about the erosion. And all of the creeks and around us have silted up. And there's no topsoil. You know, where those places were, there was no topsoil. So this element in the whole, which was man, was actually improving the environment, was actually keeping the environment in place. And so when you take him out, you change the entire equation of how that environment works together. So, if people want to be responsible for themselves and they want to be responsible for the environment, then they have to promote those processes that will protect an environment. Well, nobody has an interest in an environment like somebody who's got a 250-acre farm, because he makes his living out of it.
Well, but also someone who thinks 100 years forward.
Well, sure. And that's what you've got to, you know, that's what you've got to do. And, if, and you know, it's ironic. Catherine, but sometimes the less money you give people, the better solutions they come up with.
Absolutely.
Because they've got to, and necessity is the mother of invention. So, and as Americans, you know, we've got this, we all have this tendency, well, darn it, just go buy a new shovel, go buy two new shovels, go rent a Bobcat. Instead of thinking, what is the most economical way we can solve this problem? So,
right.
But these are things, you ask about my neighbors, I'm coming back around to that. It's very painful for me to see how over the years the government policies, which are promulgated through the county agents and the ag departments, have created a bunch of people who are dependent on that government advice or, in many cases, government money to stay on the land. And I go to these meetings, and I'm the youngest guy there, and I'm 67. I mean, the next generation, see, is not going into that. They don't want to farm.
There's a new article I just put up on the blog that was in the LA Times about how all the farmers are either over 60 or under 30. There's nobody in the middle. You know, there's nothing in the sandwich there. One of the things I will never forget is, you know, before I met you, I'd done a lot with building databases on federal money by place and looking at the finances within a place as kind of an financial ecosystem matched up with the environmental ecosystem. And I came over and you were frustrated. I forget what had happened. You'd been to a meeting and I took you into one of the websites that maps out all the government subsidy and then now no longer available, but all the government contracts and government money in your place. And your face, you were just stunned because, you know, it's very invisible. I can't tell you how many people around the country say, oh, well, you know, there's no government money here. Well, hello, more than 50% of the, you know, the family income in most places, directly or indirectly, comes out of the federal budget at this point.
Right. So, and one of the things that people ought to know about, too, is that if you look at that 50%, it is not evenly distributed in the community.
Right.
And let's take farm subsidies, for instance. I think that in the county we looked at, and I remember that incident very well. I think that in the county we looked at, 91% of the subsidies were paid to less than 10% of the people. And I know generally in Tennessee that's about the way it is, that 90% of the subsidies go to 10% of the people, and the average subsidy for the rest is like $785 a year, some ridiculous amount of money. They're winners. Whenever the government gets into the business, they're winners and losers. And the skill set that is required to get lots of government money is not the skill set that the market requires to pay you lots of money.
Right.
You follow what I'm – it's a different – in the one case, as far as the market is concerned, you have to be – like a honeybee, you have to be a fructifier. You have to make things bear fruit in a way that they haven't borne fruit before. And you have, in a sense, you're bringing forth something out of nothing. Whereas with government money, it never works that way. It's always a net drain on everybody. And
right, it makes you get stupider and stupider and stupider, and you get more and more dependent.
Right. And that's what, you know, I remember the occasion you were talking about. They were trying to push through the National Animal Identification Act, and we were trying a little bit of guerrilla warfare. I had my two sons who work with me, Justin and Wright, and then James Bendowski, who was working with us too. And we would go to these meetings, and we'd scatter out around the room to ask uncomfortable questions when the question and answer time came, because nobody was asking any questions. And what they do is they have these meetings, the county agents or the Department of Agriculture has these meetings, and they bait everybody in with barbecue. And then they tell them how to fill out the forms so they can get their government money. And so I'm in a room with 150 people, and literally, other than these three young men, I'm one of the youngest guys there. And, you know, they had the commissioner of agriculture from the state of Tennessee there, and he was telling them how they all ought to go get sign up their premises for the National Animal Identification Act, which would have meant that they'd have had to have an electronic chip in every chicken in the whole country. He's up there and he's telling them what this all means. And so I wait until it got finished. I raise my hand up. I'm in the back of this cafeteria sized room. And I said, well, can you explain to me how registering your premises is different than having a license to farm? Having to get a license to farm? Oh, no, it's not the same thing at all. He said, oh, no. I said, well, wait a minute. You just said that we won't be able to sell a cow, a chicken, a pig, anything to anybody. We won't be able to grow any of that stuff. Oh, no, he said, I didn't say you couldn't grow it. I said you wouldn't be able to sell it. That's true. Listen, Catherine, nobody in the room, one man out of 150 people came up and said anything to me. People have been so conditioned to do what the government says to get their government money that they just don't realize what a mindless state they've been brought to. Their initiative has been eaten out of them. And the saddest part of this is, talking about honeybees and fructifiers, the saddest part is there's this whole new wave of new agriculture coming on that doesn't use chemicals, that doesn't use debt, that doesn't use high cost mechanical inputs. And the people, the most amazing thing about those people, and I go to Acres USA conferences or Stockman Grass Farmer conferences or whatever, but talk to them. The most amazing thing about them is I can pick up the phone and call one of those people and say, listen, I've got this problem with this, that, or the other. And they just pour out information to you.
Right.
Charge. Right. You know, because they're so excited about what they're doing and the development of what is essentially new technology that they're ready to share it with anybody who'll listen. You know, you almost have to shut them down.
Well, it's like I went to you got me to go to Joel Salatin's one of his workshops for 2 days.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect example. Now, it's another example of somebody who's got a family, because I got to say, you know, I think it's easier to do a farming enterprise with a big family than without them. But, you know, it's a perfect example of somebody who's just figured it out and has got from a cash flow standpoint, it's got a very successful business.
Right.
But had to overcome that cultural barrier that you're talking about.
Right. But he he's a good example of offering people what they want.
Right.
See, you know, the mistake that that anybody going into business, and that, you know, I'm going to make clear that what we're talking about here has much wider applications than just farming. But when you go into business, what you've got to look for is, what do people need? And I don't have to get the whole market. So our marketing, we've heard so much about getting a big market share, and you got to be a big producer. You got to be get up big and get those economies of scale. Listen, that's not where the profits are. Raising commodities and selling commodities is not where the profits are. The profit is in the boutique market, where you've got people who want some special product that you've got, and they're willing to pay for it.
Right,
that's
exactly
where the profit is. And that was what and Joel Salatin has brilliantly located those people who wanted fresh, wholesome food, chemical-free, antibiotic-free, and he's purveyed to them. And he's made himself, I don't mean to say a celebrity, but an expert, certainly, on how to do that.
Right.
So that, you know, that's anybody who's trying to make a business work has to ask themselves this question: who is my market, and who am I competing with? And you don't want to compete with the big guys, because they don't have any profit margin anyway.
Right. So one of the other things I want to bring up, because I really think that the two books describe this well, is, you know, throughout this incredible journey, you and Susan, it reminds me of the explorers who would burn the boats. You know, you and Susan don't, you know, you have a picture that this can work, and you are not going to give up. and you know, evidence faith. And to me, one of my favorite lines from scripture is faith is the substance of things hoped for, but not yet seen. You know, this is a story of a real serious faith walk. I don't know if you saw on the blog, I used the quote from William Faulkner, a gentleman can live through anything, which I thought was a very appropriate Southern expression of what your books describe.
But, you know, I don't want people to get the idea that we're some kind of spiritual weightlifters, or because the thing is that when you go on a walk like that, you don't need faith if you think you can make it yourself. If you think you've got all the resources and all the toughness, all the resolve and cleverness, you don't need it yourself. You don't need faith, because after all, you've got everything you need. But I don't personally see how people can do that. And especially when everybody's going to come to that situation, to that point in any undertaking, when they have that sinking feeling in the pit of their stomach, and the thought runs through their mind, how did I ever get into this? I am going to drown. Why did I ever get into this? And at that point, you know, that's the point where you've got to have faith. You have to have faith that God is going to provide for you. You have to have faith that God is going to honor your intention in whatever it was you undertook. Because otherwise, I mean, I suppose there are people on earth who have enough resolve and can tighten their mental belt or spiritual belt tight enough to get them through every problem. But I'm not one of those people, and I know it.
I'm not one of those people either. I don't see how you do it without faith. I couldn't go around the block without faith at this point. And to me, you know, faith is part of how you deal with the fact that it's hopeless. It's flat out hopeless, but you just ignore that completely and you keep walking on faith. And then suddenly, you know, miracle happens and you say, okay, I'll just keep walking. And then another miracle happens. So it's, to me, it's the, you know, it's that miracle that is at the essence of fructify.
Well, all of life is a miracle. And if you make more life there, if you cause something to bear fruit, there was a miracle there somewhere.
Right.
And I think people just don't look for it. You know, Flannery O'Connor said, faith is what somebody believes even when he knows it's not true.
Well, it's not true in the material world, but the material world's not the only world operating here. So,
well, but that, you know, that's what it, if you could see it, it wouldn't be faith. It wouldn't be hope if you could see it. But what,
okay, so,
you know, people, what, when the bottom line though of this thing is that you have to believe that you can do it. You have to have faith that you can do it. You have to have faith that God will enable you to do it. And then you undertake a job and you hope that you're right. You know, you just hope.
So I want to bring back, before we finish, I want to quick talk about the books and then dive a little bit into the precious metals market before we go. But there are two books. Just quick describe what the two are, because I really, you know, these are, I'll say it because I love them. These are beautifully written books. They're a lot of fun to read. You laugh, you cry, you roll your eyes, and you think, thank God it wasn't me. And, anyway, but just quick describe what the two books are and how we can get them.
Well, they're literally a chronicle of our move to the country and what we had to learn, learning how to farm, and all the things that went wrong. I guess if everything had gone right, I wouldn't have had anything to write about. But they just chronicle all the incredible, you know, the incredibly stupid things that we did that we didn't know were stupid at the time, that we found out later were stupid. And then the successes too, the things that worked, the plans that we laid and the things that worked out. And it's just a kind of a day by day not day by day, but really they were written sort of month by month. I'd write them down as they happened. And that they bring us up through the, it's kind of like this is the first part of the learning curve. This is the part where you don't know anything at all. And then you're climbing the curve, killing animals and losing money. And and then finally get to the point where things begin to take sort of take shape and become and make more sense and begin to work. And along the way, you know, some of us have almost been killed. It's not a joke. It really isn't a joke.
Yeah, farming is a dangerous business.
Right. Well, life is a dangerous business. That's one of the lessons we've learned is to be careful. But it's cut up into so many points that they're sort of discrete stories. So you don't have to sit down and read it all at once. But one of the things that always strikes me the best about it, I guess it's what I like to write the best, is that it's funny. It's just funny the way that life turns around on us and sort of turns us inside out and then works out again. So it's just a lot of fun. And we've got a web. Go ahead.
Yeah, go and describe the website.
It's www.dogwoodmudhole.com, where you can get the books.
And we can link to it from the Money Changer, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've got it linked on the blog post. Okay, so precious metals. We can't talk to you and not hear what's up on the precious metals market. Bring us up to date on where things are and what your sense of the market is right now.
It's the most boring world that ever has been.
Sideways.
But somebody mentioned something to me that was very interesting the other day, that gold has actually gained more this year than the S&P 500 has since December the 31st.
That was true at the end of the first quarter, although the S&P's up now, so I think they're getting close.
But basically gold, other than that big rally at the beginning of the year, has been going sideways for the last several months. And
well, you know, Franklin, everything, the only thing, the best performing asset so far this year is the long treasury. To everybody's shock and amazement, everything else has been sideways. So, you know, bonds, stocks, you know, precious metals, everything sideways except the long treasury. And, you know, that's quite shocking to most everybody who thought interest rates are going to rise. And, you know, who knows where it goes from here.
Right. And and interest rates rising will be the break. That will be the thing that breaks the cycle and changes everything up. But for right now, you know, stocks are the only game in town. And gold yesterday, I think, let me look, had an $8 range. $8. They
right.
might as well not have opened up in the morning for an $8
right.
range. And, you know, silver's not much better. The last few days, they've been acting like they want to turn around. But this time of year, from June through July, is historically and seasonally a time that both of them see their lows from the year and turn around. So I've been expecting the top in the stock market either now or in the fall. But this gold and silver, I'm fairly sure, will by the end of this month will have made their ultimate low. They may spike down again. This little turnaround in the last two or three days, the last week or so, you really can't put any credibility. It doesn't have any credibility until gold gets over about $1,280 and silver gets over $1,950 or so. And then it'll be time to look at them and say, well, maybe you're coming back to life now.
Oh, I think so. Even though, you know, they're clearly, I think silver's really testing the $19 line, but I would say that they've shown more strength than I expected. And, you know, to me, I'm hopeful. I would love to find a bottom this year. So, and
well,
the one thing is that, you know, all the historical patterns on stocks say that stocks should be, you know, this should be the peak. Stocks should be correcting this summer. And the one question I have, Franklin, is if you look at how concerned the leadership is about the elections this year. I'm just wondering if the pressure to keep rates down and that equity market high isn't, you know, obscene.
Well, numerous people have noticed that the Fed's balance sheet does not show the amount of tapering they claim. So that may be going on behind the scenes. But you're right, stocks are way past the time that they ought to have turned seasonally. And,
right.
You know, markets, I think the thing that might do us some good here is to realize that markets never do what everybody expects.
Right.
Markets never do what everybody expects.
Especially
so right
in the
now,
last 5 years.
Oh. Yeah, well, there have been some hidden forces in there, too. But so right now, the mainland investing community thinks that gold and silver are finished, and they think stocks are going to go up forever. I know that certainly there are sophisticated investors who, you know, look at the indicators with stocks and say, well, there's a problem there. But wouldn't it surprise everybody if stocks kept on rising for another 4 or 5% into the summer and silver and gold went flat? I mean, wouldn't that surprise everybody? It just stayed here, just didn't do anything until August.
Here's what I think, Franklin, we have to be prepared for any possible, you know, anything can happen in the short run here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, including my biggest concern for the, you know, for the most significant risk this year is, you know, I don't think we get a financial crash. I think we get a war. So that's my biggest concern. But I think, you know, could the stock market go up another 5 to 10%? Absolutely. Could it correct here? Absolutely. There's no way to, you know, we're sort of in a very different situation in terms of the markets than we were 20 years ago. So I think we all have to get, you know, I've given up on trying to predict what's going to happen next, but just be prepared to shift and see things as they are, as they happen.
Right. Well, if you see silver up over $20.50,
that's big.
And right, and you see gold up over $13.30, then you got to throw your other expectations out the window and say, okay, that's it, they bottomed. And on the downside, if you see silver at, you know, if you see a spike to like $17.50 or on gold, $1,180, $1,200, that would be the time to jump in. I mean, I'm confident those are on that low end. And if they get up on the high end of those numbers that I mentioned, then you've got to say, well, they're rallying, and it's we've lost.
Well, I,
we've passed,
you know, I want to see them prove a bottom. So I want to, you know, I'm going to want to see that whatever the new bottom is, I'm going to want to see it hold that line a couple times, but.
Well, it would need, yeah, but yeah. It would, if it gets over 1330 and then it can get over that low from last August, that is the last, August high at 1434, if it gets over that, then there's not much arguing with it. The only hurdle left after that will be 1550 where it broke down.
Right.
So.
Okay, well. We will see what we see. There's no doubt. If you're in our business, this is a frustrating world we live in. Anyway, we will continue to fructify. And before we close, anything you want to ask?
Yeah, there was something I wanted to add, and I've thought about this, thinking about our conversation today. One of the points that I wanted to make was it helps you to help other people. It really helps you if you've, you know, to consciously try to become a fructifier, try to, when you meet other people who are struggling with a business or, you know, struggling to make it work, give them a hand, help them some way or the other. And a lot of times, you know, it's just, hey, what's your problem? Maybe I can talk you through that problem. Maybe some of my experience answers what your questions are now. But the idea that we're all alone in the world and it's every man for himself, is the one that keeps us isolated from each other, and it leads to failure. I mean, who wants to be at the top of the heap when there's nobody else there?
Well, it's very interesting. When I first started, when I had to shut down Hamilton Securities Group and I couldn't work because I was litigating, I decided as I started to do radio shows that every time I got an email and somebody asked me a question, I'd answer it.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to answer questions, and the next thing you know, I was answering hundreds of questions a month, and that went on and on and on. And that is what turned into the Samaritan Report, and then that turned into the investment advisory business. And so all the businesses grew out of me just trying to help people who ask me questions. But it was because, you know, they were, I was responding to what they wanted as opposed to any concept I had of how to be useful. I was just trying to help them.
Right. Well, you were making yourself useful.
Well, I don't know. It was pretty painful because they kept asking me all these questions and I didn't know the answer, so I'd have to go figure it out. it was kind of like the story when you read the Dogwood Mud Hole, you realize, oh, I see what this is. It's like many years of staying outside your comfort zone. Okay, well, Franklin, listen, have a wonderful time in Philadelphia. Thank you again, and we'll be looking for you on the Salary Report in a month or two, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, have a great day. Bye.
You too. God bless you. Bye-bye.